Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. With me today, I have someone who feels a lot like a blood brother to me, someone who's on a very similar path in some ways and very different in others, someone who respects the power of story, somebody who really gets the difference that an emotional connection can make. And before I introduce him, I am going to mention a link, bit.ly/powerfulvirtualleader, where this is a course that I run a number of times a year. Check that link out if it sounds interesting to you. We'd love to have you join us. If you go to that link and it's changed, that Bit.ly link will always be pointing to something that I'm doing that I think you'll enjoy. So bit.ly/powerfulvirtualleader, all small. And now let me introduce my guest, because I think you're going to love the time that we spend with him. His name is Michael Cass. You can find him at storyandspirit.org, which gives you already a massive insight into who he is and what he does. You can find him at linkedin.com/in/MichaelCass1, the number one, which doesn't give you as much of an insight as his website does. And then you can find him on instagram.com/storyandspirit, which reaffirms what he's actually committed to. So Michael, it's great to have you. Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader show. I appreciate you taking the time to join us. I just did your course. Was it called, what was that particular course called?
The course was called Organizational Storytelling for Changed Times.
Which is really relevant because times have definitely changed. And yet, I think you'd probably be the first one to agree with me that the power of storytelling has not changed.
At all. It's universal. At all.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, one of the things I say a lot about what's changed, Michael, is that I think that bad leadership works even less well and gets leveraged for a big downside even harder now. Good leadership works, you know, in some ways even better. It's certainly more important than it ever was because of the way that things have gone. And the power of story and that connection just seems to be like the antidote for the thing that's missing the most when we're all on Zoom calls and these, you know, video calls all day. Would you agree with that?
I would 100% agree with that, right? And to be even more explicit, the thing that's missing so much is connection. And humanity, yes. Right? One of the things that started happening right at the beginning of the pandemic is people thought that they could do what they did in person and just do it online. And that doesn't work, right? Because in person, we have all these ways of connecting that are just sort of implicit, right? We're all in a room together. We're sharing coffee. There's all these little small
walking ways. Down the hall to the meeting.
All of that.
Like, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah,
so what do you see people doing now? How do you overcome that lack of, we could call it lack of intimacy, even though I never really thought of it as intimate walking down the hall together, but it sure feels intimate now, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is first acknowledging what's been lost, which a lot of leaders just for whatever reason weren't able to do early on. And the second is saying, hey, what we've lost is important. And then bringing people into connection with each other. And as you were saying, story is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful way we have of doing that, especially in these virtual environments. So the most powerful thing that I've seen leaders do isn't just share their own stories, but also create environments where people can share their stories as well.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. Because then they're listening more deeply to each other. There's a sense of empathy and compassion, right? All of those aspects that we know are part of effective leadership and effective teams can be really beautifully promoted through story.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Are there other things that you're seeing teams and organizations do? Like, are there any best practices you've seen around connecting on Zoom meetings or anything like that?
One is slowing down. There's a tendency, right? Before the pandemic, when you got on a Zoom meeting, it was straight to business. just go, right? Very functional.
Totally agree. Yeah.
One of the most effective things I've seen people do is start with a story, start with breathing, acknowledge that you're not going to be able to get as much done on a Zoom meeting or a Google Meet or whatever. Really effective. And then as people have learned to navigate this new environment, bringing in other ways of connecting, whether that's like a virtual whiteboard, which is, you know, the Zoom version of sticky notes, or really effectively utilizing breakout rooms. And the other thing that's been so effective for a lot of folks I work with is creating really explicit guidelines for engagement. Because if we're in a room together, I know not to like throw spitballs, right? I know not to pass notes. On Zoom, people might be private messaging each other. People might be multitasking, which is totally understandable. But I've seen really effective leaders say, hey, let's all agree that this is the way we're going to interact in this space.
Yeah.
And that's been, it just takes all the uncertainty out of it and makes people feel much more safe and comfortable.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, one of the things, Michael, that I've been doing myself and sharing with the people I support is, at first I was really resisting the fact that it was supposed to start at the top of the hour, right? But that's when everybody hits connect, is at the top of the hour. So no one's really here till the first 3, 4, 5 minutes, you know? And I mean, I was getting really uptight about it. And then I realized, okay, well, you know, that's how it's going to be. So arguing with reality is sort of stupid. So I decided to just use that first five. Sometimes I'll even let it go to 10 minutes of a meeting to just ask people, how are you and where are you? What are you seeing? How are things, like, you're tough dealing with the kids and online school, you know? And even if I don't get to talk to everybody in the meeting that way, the fact that we're having a conversation in that space like that just has this way of relaxing everybody and having them feel a little more connected. And now I'm not sitting there gritting my teeth for the first 5 minutes thinking something else should be going on, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm so curious, when you started doing that, using those first few minutes to check in with people as human beings, how is it received? Were people, you know, you mentioned people feeling relaxed. Was that universal, or did some people kind of look like a deer in the headlights and go, oh, I'm good. Anyway, here's my results for the last quarter or whatever.
Well, you know, first of all, I would always share that other story, right? Because I wanted to get that, I would call it even that, get that poison out of the space of like the frustration and this should be some other way, right? So that would help to kind of prep people for what was going to come. But I certainly did get some people who were just like, you know, and I think that what I attributed it to and still attribute it to mostly is just not coming to the meeting thinking they were going to have to say anything, you know, being a little shy. And that's sometimes the people I might call on just because I want to get them interacting. So, you know, and certainly there's that pull for everybody, myself included, of like, you know, let's dispense with all pleasantries and just get right down to business, you know? And I get it, but it doesn't work. That doesn't work.
Doesn't. Well, especially not now, where I would say it's 100% chance that none of us are okay. Just at a fun, right? Our sense of safety over the past year, so many of us have lost people. Maybe we've been sick ourselves, whatever it is. Yeah. And so that idea that we can separate our human selves, our emotional selves, our story selves from our professional lives may have once been tenable, like not functional, but at least doable. It's I don't think we can do it anymore.
Well, you know, Michael, I've got a group that I used to lead called the Global Leadership Synchronization Call, and that we met every week, and it was really wonderful. And we just decided, like, stuff's changed enough that we're going to turn into something else. So here's what we're calling it. And it goes right along with what you said. We're calling it the Silver Linings Adventurers Club. We're meeting once a month and we're looking for those silver linings, because I think what you just said is an absolute silver lining. Like the ridiculous construct of a work-life balance just got demolished because there's no difference. Is there really a difference between your work and your life? I don't think so.
No, you know? It's so interesting and awesome that you say that, because so many of the people I work with, like I do coaching work, and that's part of what I do, they'll say, I need to work on my work-life balance. And the first conversation we have is, what if we take the word work out of it and say, let's strive for life balance, right? What's the kind of life we want to build? Because the idea, especially now where, you know, people are, we're still virtual, you're seeing my house right now.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So where there's a level of, it's a word you used earlier, intimacy that didn't exist a year ago in a lot of ways.
And Michael, you know, kind of on the down low, some of the, I'm not being on the down low, but some of the people that I support at these large organizations, they'll kind of lean in like this and say, you know, at first it was a little shocking to see inside everybody's homes and to see how everyone lived and to kind of be more in their life like that. I hope it never changes. I hope we don't give that part up because it's been really amazing, you know, to see inside each other's homes and to see the things outside of work that we're all dealing with and to just get each other's humanity in this inhumane kind of way almost, right? Like we're all on Zoom and yet it's more intimate in some ways.
Absolutely. Well, and it's really interesting if you think about the way that idea of work-life balance evolved is from essentially the Industrial Revolution and the factory system where you would go in, the thing would, the bell would ring at the end of the day, and then you go home, totally different life.
Be done. Yeah.
You're done. That's not it anymore. We all, we're getting emails at 10 p.m. Whether that's good or bad, that's a different conversation. But the idea of that crisp, clean division for a lot of us, especially people in positions of leadership, simply isn't a thing anymore.
Yeah.
And so we can rail against it the way you railed against, why is this starting 5 minutes late? Or simply say, this is a feature, not a flaw. How do we work with it, right? How do we create space for it?
You know, Michael, something dawned on me a few years ago, and I may be late to the party, but I think it's worth sharing. I was always intrigued by this idea of balance, right? And I was intrigued by the idea of the middle path, you know, the middle road, walk, stay in the center of the road. And I could never figure out why that seemed to be so hard for myself and everybody else, right? Like it's so easy to walk totally on the right or totally on the left, but to stay in the middle of that road seemed like that's way harder than it should be, right? Balance, just put things on either side of the scale, make sure they're balanced and it should stay that. But no, what I realized is it's balanced like the idea of a wheel rolling down the road, right? It takes constant input, constant energy input and investment to keep that wheel rolling and to keep it in the middle of the road. And that's balance, right? Like it's really easy. If you stop putting energy in, it just goes plonk. And it doesn't matter if it falls to the left or the right. Like the left and the right just go to the extreme. They connect again, right? But it's just, but keeping that balance takes energy. It takes intention, you know?
And awareness, because part of it is that idea of once I find that middle road or that middle path, I'll be able to stay on it.
Yeah.
Assumes a closed system. Right.
Mm.
Not only, you know, I think of a tightrope walker, right? You watch them, they're constantly rebalancing. It's not just energy they're putting in. There's also awareness of, is there a breeze? Is there a bird coming at me? So there's also all these other variables that we have to course adjust for constantly. And so, right, that idea that we're going to find the solution to a balanced life is also not a thing.
Right.
We can develop a tool set and a way of being that allows us to calibrate towards that middle path. But the idea that we'll be able to stay on it forever, we should just jointly agree to let go of that now because it's, you know, that's not a thing that's possible.
So can I ask you, what's one of the tools in your toolkit, so to speak? What's one of the things you do to achieve some balance in your life?
I breathe. I know it sounds so right, but like conscious breathing.
No, not to me. I get it.
It's such a, you know, it's one of these things we do it 20,000 times a day and most of us just don't pay attention. And so one of the ways I know that I've been pulled off center is my breathing goes. Like it'll either go up in my chest or it'll become shallow or sometimes I'll stop breathing for a minute and I won't even notice. And so one of like the most powerful tool that I have is breath awareness. And there's another one that relates to story, which is being aware of and really playing with the distinction between the stories I'm telling myself about who I am in a moment, right?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
stories we're telling others. And the most important one that very few people talk about is like, what's the story I'm inside of right now?
Yeah.
Right? Am I in a story of, you know, death and destruction with the pandemic? Or like you were saying, am I in a story where there's all of these new things, these silver linings that are appearing?
Yeah.
And what story am I inside of? And what story do I choose to be inside of?
Yeah.
I think that breath and story, incredibly powerful tools for that.
Super powerful. Yeah. I have a meditation practice that kind of is stronger and weaker, but it's made just an enormous difference for me. And a big piece of that is my breath. And then, you know, I love what is the story I'm inside of, and asking yourself that, because what I talk about is that I believe now more than ever, but I always think it's your number one job as a leader is to create an empowering context for yourself, for your life, for your team, for your work, for everything. And I think that that's actually a matter of integrity. And I think that when I say empowering context, a lot of people are like, what are you even talking about? And so what is the story you're living inside of, you know? And is this story one of negativity or positivity, right? Is it lighting you up to live in that story, or is it tearing you down?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so funny. I was talking about this with some friends yesterday, that there's another aspect to it, especially with leadership, that part of the role of the leader is to create a sense of safety for the team.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This idea, you're safe here, so you can mess up, right? That whole idea of psychological safety in a team.
Yeah.
It's okay to mess up. It's okay to be human. It's okay to take a day off because whatever happened, right?
Yeah.
And that when people feel held in that way, there's a sense of, oh, now I can explore this potential idea that might have felt risky otherwise.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you hear about toxic work environments or toxic leadership, a lot of it boils down to you're creating a place that does not feel safe for people at a fundamental level. Right?
Yeah.
And
yes. Yes. Well, so gosh, there's a couple things that come up for me. Let's talk about this one in a second, but I just want to put a pin in the book Creativity by John Cleese when it comes to that safe space. But the first thing I want to go right to is I would love to get your thoughts and feedback and some insights from you. I'll tell you the term that I'm trying to coin, and then you tell me if it fits into what you're thinking. Is that fair? Okay. So the term that I'm coining is insightful vulnerability. Insightful vulnerability, not just your vulnerability, but also what's an insight from that? What's a lesson?
Yep.
What did you get from that mistake or failure or whatever? And I believe that leaders who practice insightful vulnerability begin to create that safe space where other people can talk about their mistakes, and the goal becomes not just to talk about your mistake, but to bring the insight to it and share that insight. So now no one else in the organization will make that mistake because they learned that lesson because you were safe enough to share it.
I love that. I think that's such a beautiful way of putting it, because there's a, you know, vulnerability with Brené Brown's TED Talk and everything that came after that.
She's
amazing.
Love.
But vulnerability has become, I think, fundamentally misunderstood in leadership.
I think you're right.
Right?
I totally think
you're right. Where people say, I can't be vulnerable. I can't tell people everything. And I love the idea of just saying to them, no, vulnerability is not full disclosure. We're talking about insightful vulnerability, where you know,
exactly.
Like, you're sharing with courage, you're sharing with bravery, you're sharing vulnerably, and it's not just to do it. It's not just because Brené Brown told me to.
Yeah, right. Right? Brené Brown said, I got to tell you something I screwed up.
Yeah. But it's so that you can open up and empower others by sharing your experience, by sharing your story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love that.
A great quote for you, if you want it, is from Les Brown. He says, people don't connect with your successes. They connect with your messes. Your message is in your mess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. And I think you've got to tie that insight to it.
Yeah, insight. And if you think about, It's funny because I do an exercise with many people where I say, tell a story, just like you were saying, about a time you really messed up, right? About a mess you made.
Yes.
The story is never about the mess. The story is about the learning. So they're, yeah, right, they're connecting with, yeah, that shift from hopelessness and like, oh my goodness, the wheels, yeah, fell off the wagon, we're never going to, yeah, make it, to some sort of shift or change, right? Yeah. And that's what they take away from it. Yeah. And that's a story, right? That's a very, yep, classically structured hero's journey where you were trying to do something, it got messed up. There's that all is lost moment. We're never going to make our numbers. We're never going to whatever. And, yeah, then we realized that we hadn't plugged in the computer. Oh, right. Hey, now everybody's, yeah, going to go try to plug their computer in, right? Yeah. It can be that simple. And that, you know, until relatively recently, I think even that level of vulnerability as a leader, owning that you are a fallible human being, was, yeah, was taboo. Like we weren't allowed to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, if you look at the greatest leaders throughout time, they all did that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was like squeaking over here about too, right? Yeah. Like it's not great leaders that keep all their cards to their chest and don't share anything and are never vulnerable. That's just, I think that's scared leaders.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, and it's a fear of, if, you know, I was working with a client around fear of public speaking the other day and she went, well, can you just give me some quick exercises? I went, sure. Yeah. They won't do anything because, yeah, here's what's happening. What are you really afraid of? She goes, judgment. I'm like, great. What happens if you get judged poorly? She goes, well, I could lose my job. I'm like, okay. What happens if you lose your, and eventually we get to, oh, you'll become homeless and die. So for her, yeah, right, the fear of public speaking, and that's what I think a lot of leaders, those leaders that operate from fear, hold.
Yeah. Right?
If I show, yeah, people I'm human, if I go down deep enough into the rabbit hole, it's a fear of death. It's, yeah, I will cease, yeah, to exist, right?
And you know, Michael, just so I'm responsible for what I said here, it's not about being fearless. I will also grant people that, right? Because, mm-hmm, fearless just gets you killed. You know, my dad, the Marine, taught me that early. You don't want a fearless foxhole buddy. You want a courageous foxhole buddy. Mm-hmm. Someone who has their fear, but something matters to them more than their fear. So they step through it.
Right.
Right. And that's what we're talking about. Yeah. And that's why this is so inspiring, because there's nobody on earth who's, I mean, there are some, they're called sociopaths, but, right, there's nobody on earth who's not scared a little bit to admit in front of the people they're supposed to be leading that they screwed something up or they did something, mm-hmm, dumb or they had an embarrassing moment, right?
Yeah. And I think for me, it's even more than overcoming a fear or moving through it. For me, it's always been about walking with the fear. So,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
acknowledging it and saying like, yeah, cool, I hear you. I'm not saying you're wrong, fear buddy, or
no,
whatever
you're,
you
right,
want to call him. You're right, but why don't you hang out over to the side because this is more important. Right?
I'm going
to
do it anyway.
I'm going to, yeah, do it anyway. And then the fear, if I think of the fear as like an entity or a consciousness of its own, it gets to learn by watching, yeah, me be courageous, just, yes, as everyone on my team gets to learn from that courage, not just from the story itself, but from the way of being inhabited, yes, by the leader as they share it.
That just took me to a whole different level on this. I think that's a brilliant point. Because it's not that you're ever going to get to the point where you have no fear, but you could get to the point where your fear has learned along with you.
Yep.
And having it standing beside you is just a different experience than, yep, it used to be, right?
Absolutely.
That's so powerful. I love that. I mean, and you know, let's be honest, right? Because look what happened at Jesus and Joan of Arc and Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy and Socrates, and it goes on, right? Mm-hmm. They got noticed by the group and,
yep,
so that dying homeless thing, it's not so ridiculous. You,
no,
know, it's maybe a little bit out there for today, but you know,
maybe, but
yeah, still danger, you know,
yeah,
dangerous to get noticed by the group.
Yeah. Well, and especially if your vision, like that form of transformational change that you stand for as a leader, if that goes against the status quo in a meaningful way, then, you know, it can be quite literally dangerous, right?
And I mean, with social media and all, yeah, that stuff, like it's true.
Yeah.
It's totally true.
Yeah. And so it becomes about, you know, is it worth it to me? Is that vision powerful enough for me to acknowledge that fear that in some cases is very real and say, actually, it's really important that this message, this vision, or this idea get out there. And I'm going to plant my flag on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really inspirational. Fearless is not inspiring. It might be incredible to watch, but it's not inspiring. No. So is there a place in your life where you have a mess up story like that and an insight that you got?
Oh my gosh, so many. I mean, I remember, let me see what wants to come up. It's just when I started out, I was so cocky. I was working with Story, right? And I was like
tell us a little bit about your history, because I didn't really walk people through your path to where you are. So you could tell us a little bit of that and then get us to that cocky moment.
Yeah, a little bit. So I started out, you know, on these two roads that kept converging and diverging. One was as an actor and performance storyteller. So I don't come from like a leadership or coaching background originally. I came into that. And then the other
one. I was in a rock band, so I'm with you.
There you go, right? And so as that, we have a certain fluency with performance and stage presence and all of those things. And the other side for me was in nonprofits and nonprofit management, nonprofit consulting and leadership. And, you know, eventually where I got to was I burned out on the nonprofit, because the more I started doing that work, the less space there was for my own creativity, for my own storytelling. Yeah. And, you know, I pretty much went into, you could call it a depressive episode, you could call it a healing crisis, but it definitely a place where I became non-functional for a little while. And
can I ask you about that? Because it seems like there's something magical about people who can do that nonprofit work, because how that, like, there are such deep crying needs out there, and the closer you get to them, the more obvious and just incredible they become. And yet, if you let that suck you in, then you can't be as functional. Was that a little bit of what it was for you? It just got so much?
A little bit. Yeah. Part of it was that. And part of it was like, I knew that as noble and beautiful as that work was, it wasn't what I was supposed to be doing.
Even bigger.
There was that. And that's in the nonprofit world, there's a whole new movement afoot around well-being for people in the social impact sector, because so many, especially leaders in that space, fall victim to, you call it the martyr complex, right?
Yeah.
How dare I take care of myself when there is, like, just like you said, such incredible need out there, right?
Yeah.
And then they collapse and their organization collapses, and ultimately they can't be of service to anyone.
Right.
Right. And so part of that's actually a fair bit of my work now is working with leaders around well-being. Yeah. But at the time, you know, 10, 11 years ago when I burned out, one of the things that got me through it, one was doing like a lot, just kind of taking the needle off the record of my life and saying like, yeah, and focusing on the inner work and going like, oh my goodness, this is a mess in here. Let's see what's going on. And then when I got back from that, was really realizing I love nonprofits. I love storytelling. Leaders in social impact are terrible about talking about their work. Like awful, awful.
Awful. Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, absolutely.
And this stuff that was intuitively obvious to me, I would go in and I'd talk to them about it and they go like, what? My story matters, right? It became this huge thing.
Yes, yeah.
Right? And so here's a mess up story. And it's not the one I thought I was going to tell. It's different, which is the way story sometimes works. Is early on, I thought I was just working with people on story. Like, how do you structure a good story? How do you do this? And I remember speaking with a leader at a tech company who was a woman of color. And we were talking about her leadership story and her journey. And there came a point where she stopped because two things were happening at once. One, her throat had closed up. She wasn't sick. She just couldn't get the words out. And the other is she started sobbing. She started crying.
Yeah.
And at that moment, like, I felt awful. Because at the time, I didn't really have any idea what was going on. And I felt utterly powerless to help her, right? Because this was somebody who I respected and admired and who had entrusted me with this work. And I had brought her to a place that I did not know how to get her out of or help her navigate, right?
Yeah.
And we muddled through it. But that really keyed me in a very deep way into, when you're working with story, you're working with soul, right? You're working Absolutely. With somebody's deep truth, and you will stumble across trauma, which is what happened in this case. And so, you know, that episode, and like, as I'm sharing the story, I'm feeling in my body what it felt like to be in that situation, really was a pretty insistent invitation for me to get educated around trauma, around somatics, around the way our bodies store stories, around the idea that, you know, the difference between a story that you may want to work out in therapy and the difference you may want to, between that and the story you may want to share as a leader is huge. And sometimes you work with leaders who want to share a story they're not ready to share yet. Right.
Yeah.
And that's not, what's the term you used? What was it? Vulnerability?
Insightful and vulnerability.
That's not insightful vulnerability. That's just vulnerability.
Yeah. But it's kind of like, it's not quite cooked yet.
It's not cooked. Right? It's not ready to be shared. And going back to the idea of part of leadership being creating a sense of safety as a leader, if you share that kind of story before it's ready, people won't feel safe because you don't feel safe.
Right.
Right. It's not because they're in danger. It's because they're looking to you for leadership and you're lost in yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. It was such a huge learning experience for me that moment.
Well, yeah. And I get that question a lot from people, right, John? Mm-hmm. Like, what's too much? Mm-hmm. And I love to hear your thoughts on this because I think we could work this out even a little better than what I have. But I always say, you know, if you haven't worked through it yet, then maybe it's too early to share it. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to be totally over it. Like, you're not totally over it, Michael, but you shared it, you've worked it out, still brings up that feeling in you. You know, I had a dot-com company. We raised over $80 million and then went out of business in the dot-com crash. Mm. And, you know, I talk about that a lot. And it still gives me a stomach ache. Like, I really loved the people that invested in us and I wanted to make them proud and happy, not make them have to pull the plug and lose $80 million, you know? So, but I've processed that story, right? And I've drawn the lessons out of it and it still makes me emotional, but it doesn't have me anymore. I have it.
Exactly. Right. There's a, you know, I was until recently, I lived in Southern California, so I would work with people who surfed. And so the metaphor I would always use is you want to surf the waves of emotion. You don't want to get tumbled by them. Because if you get tumbled by them, right, it's chaotic and messy. And right. Yeah. You want to be in a different environment when that's happening, not on a stage in front of 500 or 1,000 people or whatever. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I agree completely. And the other thing that I see if people are able to do is tune into their own intuition as to whether the story is ready to be shared, right? Because most folks, and they go like, well, somebody said that I should share this story. I'm like, okay, cool. What does your body tell you? What does your own innate wisdom tell you? And they go like, it might be a couple of years before I'm ready. Cool. Let's wait a couple of years and find a different story.
So I want to, I noticed the time already. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, So I have two more questions that I want to make sure we get in the time we have. And then maybe you can come back.
Awesome.
I think there's more conversations for us to have.
Absolutely.
So here are two things. You can start with either one, but one of the things that I say a lot is communication with human beings is not logical. It's biological. Mm-hmm. And when you understand the biology, you can make it logical again. But if you go in with logic by itself, you'll just never be as effective as you could be. So that's, love to hear your thoughts on that. The other one I'd love to hear about, maybe we start with this one or whatever you want to do, is people who look at me sincerely and say, but John, you know, like you train the astronauts, you used to be a surfer, you sang in a rock band, you have good stories. I don't have any good stories.
That's the end of that one.
Do you never hear that? Do you
never work that
with people who think they don't have any stories?
Yeah, of course you do, right?
Yeah.
And that's so much of the work is, and it's one of the things that the keynote speaker culture, one of the great harms it did to people is that it centered sensational stories. It's centered stories of like, totally, oh, you trained astronauts and you did this.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I remember seeing a keynote by an amazing guy who was like quadriplegic or and had done these amazing things. So the blind man who climbed Everest. I'm like, those are amazing people. And you, person X, who I'm working with, are no less amazing. Right?
I agree.
Your story is the beauty of human stories is often in these small overlooked moments. So it's almost like those epic transformational journeys are the low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that I'm really interested in are stories like, what's the first moment that you realized that you belonged anywhere, like to something greater than yourself, right?
Yeah.
What's a small moment that you realized you had something to offer? And you get these beautiful gems of stories that are so nuanced and human. So yeah, of course you come across that.
Both of those questions bring little mini tears to my eyes just to hear you ask them, right?
Yeah.
Well, and you know that the keynote culture, like I've been I don't know why this is in the space for me so much lately, but this conversation keeps coming up. I talk about it like a restaurant with a great view.
Huh.
You ever been to a restaurant with a great view
and
the food is like worse than mediocre, but they're still doing really well because they have a great view?
Yeah.
Oh, nothing drives me crazier. Like you've been given this unbelievable gem and you're just letting it sit there.
Yeah.
Drives me insane.
That's it. And so, right, what I always ask people is like, where's the beauty? Where's the power in those small moments? I call them intimate epics. That you can share and tease it. Yeah, you like that? Feel free to use it.
Yeah, I love it. I'll quote you.
Yeah, and one of the most beautiful things is watching people discover those small moments and how powerful they are, right? And to watch them, you know, even in a small group, share one of those intimate epics with another person and watch that other person's face light up as the impact of Atlanta is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And part of that goes to your second question, the second, which is really the first question, which is the reason that happens is we're biologically wired to respond to each other in that way, right? Yes. We are, are the only reason, well, one of the only reasons that we've survived as a species is because when we communicate well and effectively and in a human way, our bodies elicit oxytocin, which is our empathy hormone, right?
Yep.
And when you, I think this is what you're getting at, when people communicate from their left brain, and they present data, nobody cares. They don't take it in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even though to you, it may be very convincing, unless somebody else already shares your opinion, it'll just bounce right off like a bulletproof shield.
It's exactly what I say. Bounces right off.
Bounces right off. And if you take the time to connect in that human way, then not only is it more fun, you're also working with our biology, as opposed to trying to circumvent it. And it can become a lot of fun to do it that way, not to mention more effective and all of those things as well. Yeah.
Spot on, you know, spot on. I tell people, until you have an emotional connection, all the logic in the world just bounces right off.
And do you find that sometimes, you know, I definitely find this, I tell that to people and they go, all right, so I have to assemble a really well-structured story. And they come at story in a really logical way.
Logical.
But they're not emotionally connected to it.
Yeah.
So the other thing I would say is like, look, if you're not emotionally connected, nobody else, I guarantee you, nobody else will be either.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, mirror neurons. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
Mirror neurons. If you don't feel it, then we have no hope of feeling it.
Yeah.
So good.
And I'm, you know, so, I'm just thinking,
Go ahead and say what you're going to say.
Just going back to the story that you were talking about losing the company in the dot-com crash, right? If there ever comes a moment that you don't feel sick to your stomach telling it, then, right?
I've lost touch with it.
Yeah.
Well, and I tell people, it's really interesting you'd say that because it's one of the things that I feel like is a secret key. When people, and I watch this, Michael, I watch this all the time. So I'll give you the general thing and then I'll give you a specific example. Like I tell people, go back to the exact moment. Mm-hmm. That exact moment will always be available to you with its full emotional power. And then what people do is they go back to that and it's kind of a lot. And so they go back to pretty close to that.
Yeah.
And then as they get giving it in bigger and bigger audiences, they go back, not quite as close even. And then they go kind of to that general time. Mm. No, that exact moment. And what I watch is people will get their stories crafted, say, for an event where they're under a lot of pressure. All eyes are watching. They have to work with me. And then we get it and it's perfect. And we keep making them do it till it's perfect. And they'll go out and absolutely blow people away. I mean, I'm thinking about who's going to be on the podcast, and we'll talk about this in his podcast, but just absolutely blew the doors off the entire audience of top leadership at this very big company. Then we worked again about 8 months later, and we thought it was a shoe-in, right? Just get him to come do that talk again because it's so perfect. But he'd gotten away from the moment,
yeah.
And he didn't do it just like he knew would really work. He did it pretty close. And the problem is, and this is a problem a lot of people I work with have, he's still the best speaker at the conference, but it's nowhere near as good as it could be.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that just, like, I think there's a theme coming up for me that's one of the things that drives me insane.
Yeah, right. When you get positive reinforcement for a mediocre performance, it's like the worst thing you can get as a speaker because
it's not a good thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Now that's your bar. Your bar is mediocre, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And it's hard because what you realize is when you really are speaking and you blow the doors off, that is, it asks a lot of you. Right?
Yeah.
Because you can't, you have to be fully present with it, which is why, like, your experience in a rock band and surfing for that matter, which requires absolute presence, or mine
if you check out, you get whacked.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Or my experience as an actor where you literally have to say the same words hundreds of times and have them be full of emotion. Right. When you have executives who haven't had those experiences, then they do it once and they're like, oh, I'll just do it that exact same way again. Then they've missed it. Right.
Yeah. That will not work.
It won't. It will never, ever work because your audience is different. You're different. Right. They may be the same words, but the energy behind it is never going to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Which for me and you is fun. And for some other people is like, that's terrifying. I don't ever want to fit. I mean, that was great. And also, I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. Well, and then they find themselves in this situation where what they're out to cause in the world needs them to do it again.
That's right.
And again and again.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you found that that's a powerful way to get people to realize or really tap back into the elemental power of whatever the talk is. It's like this is, it's not about the talk. It's about what you want to achieve with it, right? What are you serving?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, I see that we just have a couple minutes left. Is there anything else that you would love to just say or share or that I didn't ask about?
I just really appreciate this conversation and I appreciate your energy. I remember having you in the class going, first of all, I had no idea who you were. You were the one, you were sort of the black sheep who came in and I'm like, this guy's great. Who is he? So I so appreciate your energy and everything that you bring to your work. And I'm so grateful to connect and be able to have this conversation.
Well, likewise, Michael. And like I said at the beginning, having watched you from, the back of the room as the black sheep, I really feel like we're on the same team.
Absolutely.
Like, I think we're out to accomplish very similar things for the world. Mm-hmm. And I really wish you all the best in your endeavors. And if I can ever be of service, I'd love to be. And maybe sometime when the pandemic is past and we can get together in person and stuff, we could do split a day up between us and see what happens, do a workshop or something. Cause I hear so much of myself in what you say, and yet it's so different than how I would say it. And I feel like there's a great triangulation possibility in that kind of a thing. So I'm sure that there'll be things that we get to do together somehow, some way. And I just wish you all the best. And I love what you're doing.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Likewise. And I would love to team up on something in the future. So we'll sort of hold the intention for that and see how it wants to work itself out. Yeah.
Sounds great.
Awesome.
Okay, good. Well, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, John.
And have a great rest of your week here.
You too. Thanks, John.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.